We knew this was coming. They basically had signaled that they were going to trade McNeil. They really didn't have a place for him anymore the way they once did. And it just is another person that was there a long time, another homegrown fixture who is out the door. It's, of course, kind of a whole thing now, right? Nimmo, Alonso, McNeil, all homegrown, all career-long Mets. Edwin Diaz was not homegrown. He was acquired in a trade, but certainly he had been there a while as well. They obviously are trying to change things around in a big way, and not just from a performance standpoint. They clearly did not like what was going on in the clubhouse. You can say, well, the clubhouse was certainly fine in 2024, and it was. 2025, for whatever reason, was different, and it's not Juan Soto walking in the door that sent the Mets crumbling. It's just a situation where they obviously feel things had gotten stale, things had gotten sour, and they have taken steps, rightly or wrongly, to make some changes.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, December the 28th, 2025. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on the new and improved. Check us out over at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Sign up for a free chat. Interact with the show. Get updates on the latest editions of the podcast. And if you so desire, sign up for some premium content for less than a cup of coffee a month. You won't regret it over at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Welcome to what probably is, you never know with the news cycle, but our last show of 2025. Wow, what a year. It's been a wild ride. And the last month, and I don't think I'm bloviating here or being a little dramatic, but I think the last month of covering the Mets, being a fan of the Mets, whatever you want to call it, I think has been one of the toughest months in a long time, maybe that I ever remember. And what's funny is that not a single pitch was thrown, not a single game was played. There's no wins, there's no losses, there's no heartbreaking ninth inning blown leads or strikeout with the bases loaded and nobody out. It's just been transactions or inactivity or typical hot stove December baseball stuff that we talk about. But because of the consecutive moves, or lack thereof, that David Stearns made with trading Brandon Nimmo and then letting Pete Alonso and Edwin Diaz go and then putting pretty much the cherry on top of what you want to call the core Mets that have been here for the longest since 2019 or earlier, with Jeff McNeil being traded to whatever you want to call them, Sacramento, Oakland, the A's, whatever they're called now. Really, this has been for Mets fans, especially Mets fans, and Mets fans are a group of fans that they'll get attached to some random player in team history. Like, there are so many people like myself that love a player like Mackie Sasser. In the scheme of baseball, Mackie Sasser is not a blip on anything, but for a Mets fan who grew up during that era, Mackie Sasser was a fun player, and we get attached to players like that. And you know, there's tons of examples from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, turn of the century, whatever. But whether you agree or disagree with what has happened in a hot stove that has gone completely different than anybody, myself included, could have predicted, this has been a transformative month in Mets history. It's a situation that I think will be a theme going into the new year, going into the season. It's going to be, and I really believe this was a fork in the road for Stearns during his tenure. He's going on year three of a five-year deal. And I think he took a sharp left turn here. No political pun intended, by the way, with the organization, with the core players, with some really difficult decisions he had to make, and you know, has put his, you know, planted his feet firm and told us pretty much who he is and what he believes in and how he wants to build a team. So as we go through today's show, we'll get into maybe we haven't been really paying attention to what Stern's teams are all about. And I went back and I looked a little bit at some of his teams in Milwaukee. We could bring up the question that has been thrown a little bit out on this show and maybe dabbled in throughout different media spaces, but are the Mets rebuilding or retooling? There was a little bit of a debate I was having on X about that. I don't think they are, but we'll bring it up. And the media is up to their old tricks, but I'll tell you what, this edition of their, what do you want to call it, LOL Mets, Mets for clicks, whatever you want to label it this time, I call it rage baiting now, I think it's going to be much more detrimental and insidious, and I think it's got a really mean component to it. It could have some very negative, long-lasting, possibly, in terms of players, transformative nature to players on the roster. And I'm pretty disappointed in some of the participants in it, not surprised on others. So we'll talk about that a little bit here on the final, possibly final, Talking Mets podcast here of 2025. So the core has been the story of the last month, the breaking up of the core. It's one of, and if you haven't voted yet, please go to X, or you could go on the Substack, or you could go on the chat. You could send me an email, MikeSilvat@TalkingMetsPodcast.com. The core is one of the three choices, and you could also do a write-in if you want, of what is the Talking Mets, we do this yearly, person of the year, event or player or situation that shaped the 2026 calendar year. The breaking up of the core is one. Juan Soto's near 40 year is another. The pitching collapse is a third. No, I kind of kicked myself a little bit. Maybe I should have put Pete Alonso's home run breaking season in there. I think he kind of fell into the core, so I left it out. You know, tar and feather me if you want. I have seen some write-ins for that, but you could have that too. So the core is going to be potentially one of the biggest stories, how the Mets had this core. And you heard Ken Rosenthal coming in on the foul territory commentary that he put out there. Maybe the core got stale. Stern saw them as hitting their ceiling, whatever. But this is going to be what I think shapes Stern's tenure. Because if this doesn't work out, the fan anger, the media temperature that's going to get amped up is going to be really hot. And we don't know yet how on board Steve Cohen is with it. We know that he's given his president of baseball operation autonomy, something that we've talked about for so many years that hasn't happened here, is happening, and now nobody likes it. It's always be careful what you wish for. You might just get it. And I think that will start out by saying there's this idea from a big chunk of fans and media that part of the job of the GM or president of baseball operations is to listen to the fans and make sure that their seat at the table as a stakeholder in this when it comes to roster building is pacified or taken into account. And by nature of the job, that sometimes is part of it. But we all are stakeholders. The community is a stakeholder in the team. The fans, obviously, they pay the bills. And the people that work for the organization, there's all these different stakeholders, the media, what have you. The fans are the stakeholder that tends to have the loudest voice and has this idea that they can, and maybe it's a generational thing where there's, like I say this all the time, there's a generation of fans, especially maybe a little bit younger, that are taught you could just throw tantrums and scream and yell and put media pressure and things will happen for you. Because in the greater world that we have pacified some really bad ideas because of loud yelling that could just be ignored. And one of the things that, for some reason, that has been misconstrued by a large segment of the fan base, and maybe it's just the social media part, is that if a player is deemed popular or the fans like them, it's the Mets' job, it's Cohen's job, it's Stern's job to keep that player, regardless of how that plays into the greater scheme of the financials of building the team and long-term prospects and what have you. There's also this idea that because we as fans and media are stakeholders in this, that we're entitled to some kind of blow-by-blow State of the Union from the owner or the GM, president of baseball operations, on a fairly consistent basis. And that's not true either. What we are entitled to is a proper investment, which Cohen has clearly done and will continue to do, and a competent long-term balance with short-term plan, which just because we don't see it and it doesn't meet the needs of what we wanted going into this offseason and doesn't even match, I mean, personally, what I laid out back in early October, what I'd like to see, just because none of those things are transpiring doesn't mean there's not a plan. So then it goes into something I've said. Well, did Stearns lie to us? Because I always say he doesn't lie to you. He gives you the answers. Sometimes you got to follow the breadcrumbs. He's not going to lay out the program to you, but he'll give you enough where you can get an idea of where things are going. Well, he did say that they wanted Alonso and Diaz back, and they did, but he didn't say the details of what he would go to in terms of lengths to bring those players back. Now, you could say the lengths that he was willing to go for Diaz could have got it done if Diaz played ball. He didn't. The lengths he would go to bring back Alonso were probably well below what Alonso was going to accept, so maybe he lied a little bit, or it was a lie of omission, maybe. But he did tell us that Beatty would get time at third. He did mention Carson Benj as a possibility. He's already shown us late in the season that he was willing to incorporate not one, not two, but three young starters, two of which might not have been ready into the rotation down the stretch at a time where they were trying to make the playoffs. And as far as Nimmo McNeil, well, Nimmo and McNeil had been bandied about as possibly players they were willing to move for a while. The only reason we didn't think Nimmo was going to happen is because of the no-trade clause and because of the contract. McNeil, I remember as, you know, recently or as far back as maybe the trade deadline, there was talk of them getting some interest in McNeil. I think it is interesting how they wound up trading McNeil and a chunk of his salary and not bringing back anything but a lottery ticket low-level reliever, because I'm sure there could have been better deals out there, which makes you wonder they did not want to take on extra salary or fill up a roster spot. Well, basically, McNeil traded, they brought in Weaver, but you know where I'm going here. They could have probably gotten more, could have made some roster machinations, which makes you wonder, is there something more at play here? Now, all along, our desire, and that includes me, was to keep all these beloved long-term Mets. I even like McNeil. I think McNeil is a very valuable player. I think he's a guy that is perplexing to me. I saw some things out there where there was some numbers that maybe the shift, and when there was a shift, he was really a big benefactor of that, going the other way, dinking and dunking hits around the infield that now you can't do because everybody's either on the left or the right side of the infield, maybe. But I still think McNeil, as he tried to evolve as a hitter and be more of a power guy, a line drive guy, held some value. He was hurt late in the year, which I think made his 2025 numbers look worse than what they were trending towards, which was about an 800 OPS. I mean, loved Nimmo all this time, on base, run creation machine, turned more into a RBI guy. Didn't like that version as much, but still a guy that just everything that you like, homegrown Met, good personality, you know, guy with good values, all the things that you want in a ball player. Now, heard stories that maybe it wasn't as wholesome as you think. Maybe he's more of a clubhouse problem than you think. I wasn't there. I don't know. That's not for us to really worry about anymore. And then as far as Diaz and Pete, I mean, I've said Diaz will go down until we see somebody else as the best reliever, best closer in Mets history. One of the best stories of all time. And Pete Alonso, another great homegrown Mets story. All-time home run leader. Both will come back and will one day be elected into the Mets Hall of Fame. And that includes Nimmo, too. So three of the four. So when they come back, when the career is over and all the dust is settled and all the hard feelings are put away, they'll be back and they'll be remembered very fondly in Mets history. Now, a lot of presidents of baseball operations that came into this thing 2 years ago would have tore this thing down from day one. A lot. And for years, when even Jeff Wilpon was still in charge and they were looking to move on from the Sandy Alderson era, most of the young executives wanted to come in and wanted to have the autonomy to rip the thing apart to the studs and start completely over. And myself, the fans, the Wilpons, everybody said, no, 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 can't do it. Not in a town with the Yankees. Not because of the bad history we have. Not because of all the disappointment of how they did not leverage and they did not capitalize on that great pitching. Can't do it, can't do it, can't do it. So kept kicking the can down the road, kept shoehorning things. And Stearns came in, and yes, he fired Buck Showalter day one, which I wasn't happy about. But and he didn't get rid of every single front office type, every single executive, and he pretty much kept the roster together and gave it a chance, which in June of 2024, we know the trajectory it went, gave it a chance to do something. I think deep down he knew he was going to eventually have to do what he was going to do here, but he was going to let things transpire so that it wasn't force-fed, that he could look in the mirror and he could even look at the fans and he could still say to the fans when he does reemerge publicly, hey, I gave this roster a chance to prove to me that they were part of the long-term solution. Now, money, and this is the part I have a real issue with, money plays into all this. Because forget about the CBA and what's going to happen next offseason. You have two players, two of the top 10 players in the sport, in Lindor and Soto, that are making about $95 million. If $300 million is that demarcation line for tax, almost a third of your payroll is tied up in two players. If you wanted to have Nimmo McNeil, Alonzo Diaz, that's another $99 million-ish, $100 million-ish, that you'd need to invest in the next 3 to 5 years. And you want to say McNeil would have been off the books in a year, that's true, get it down to maybe 84, 85 million. Yes, you'd be correct on that. But that's still now $200 million for basically six players on the roster. And Stearns is sitting back, and unlike you and unlike me, he's saying, look, I gave these guys a chance 2 years ago to get to the NLCS. And I think that that's all they're, that's, you know, that's the best they're going to go. I've got a rich owner. I've got a top farm system. I still got two of the top 10 positional players in the game. I've got these young arms. Why would he invest that kind of money in those players if he doesn't believe in them? And here's the other part. As the owner, and I know what everyone's going to say, well, he's the richest owner in the sport. He's worth $20 billion. The Dodgers would just suck it up and bring the players in. Why do you have to make these decisions when you're the kind of big market team the Mets are? Well, I think that's part of sports. Unless you're willing to see the payroll go to $500, $600 million, and whether we want to argue or not that the revenues are there, apparently they don't feel they are. He's going to have to, he had to make a decision and say, look, I choose the guy I brought in, and I don't believe for a minute he wasn't on board with Soto. Yes, I think Cohen had to get involved to close the deal. Any kind of deal of that magnitude requires the owner. But Stearns had to bless off on investing the kind of money, the kind of payroll, $60 million, $55 million a year for this player. I mean, he has said, you know, players like that, the kind of hitter that Soto is, they don't come around. Yeah, you could argue, do you want Bellinger? Do you want Kyle Tucker? Pete Alonso, these are very good hitters. They are not Soto. There's nobody on the market right now, offensively, that's like Soto. They just don't come around those kind of players. So let's not even compare. And, you know, he started to look at all this and he said, look, it's time for me to do things my way. And as we get, and we'll do in the later in the show, we'll talk about it. I think we've been derelict, and I've been derelict in my responsibility not to go back to the Milwaukee days and see how he's built teams, because we've always assumed that, well, he's got money now, everything that he did in Milwaukee doesn't count. Now he can enhance the way he spent money and the kind of star players he had access to that he wouldn't have had access to in Milwaukee, like Soto, but the foundation of how he believes in team building, well, it's there in front of us. Shame on me for not even thinking about that. And I think he's kind of been laying in the weeds looking to build up his organization and his farm system all this time before he started aggressively implementing. And I think the not making the playoffs in the way the second half went almost gave him the equity that he wouldn't have had up to that point. On June 12th, when the Mets had one of the best records in baseball and David Peterson had just come off of a complete game shutout of the Nats, he did not have the equity to do what he did today. 90 to 120 days later, he did. And it happened, you know, almost a complete 180. So is this crazy? I mean, I don't think it's crazy. Does it hurt? Of course, it stings. I'm not happy about it. I'm not happy about how things went down. I'm not happy that come opening day, the all-time home run leader that's homegrown is not going to be in the lineup. The best closer I've seen in my lifetime in Diaz is going to be playing for the enemy, playing for a team that has an abundance of riches, that a homegrown player from the first Alderson draft, great guy, Moneyball player personified before he kind of changed his game, Brandon Nimmo's not going to be there. And look, I still like Jeff McNeil. He always was a dirt ball-y type of player. But ultimately, Stearns was brought in, and why he's here was to do things the way that made him successful in Milwaukee. Because if the Mets were as successful in the last decade as Stearns was in Milwaukee, well, shoot, he wouldn't be here. And you look at when Stearns took over, yeah, his first year they won 73 games, but starting in 2017, they won 86, 96, 89, throw out COVID, 95, 86, and then his final year when he was a consultant, 92. They had a couple, they win the playoffs, all, you know, basically one, two, three, four of those seasons. Actually, no, five if you count 2023. You know, didn't go to the championship series, usually lost in the first round or the division series. Actually, they went to the NLCS 1 year, went to game seven in 2018. That was the closest, and that was the 96 win team. That's probably Stearns' best team. Had a great manager. And, you know, if the Mets were that successful, you know, he wouldn't be here. And that's why he's paid $10 million a year. That's why he's brought here, to make these kind of tough decisions. To give us the medicine that we've been avoiding for almost two decades. Omar Minaya couldn't do it. Sandy Alderson didn't do it. Brody Van Wagenen certainly didn't do it. Zach Scott and Billy Epler weren't here long enough to do it. And I don't think they had the ability or the cojones to do it. They all did what I've been wanting to do, what you've been wanting to do, what the media's been wanting to do, is they all shoehorned the future with whatever present they have to make sure that the fans were kept pacified, that their popular players weren't touched, that the illusion of continuity was there. Now, maybe it's easier for Stearns to do what he's doing because some of the fruits of the labor that he came here with, that, be honest, of Billy Epler with some of the drafts, with even to a certain degree, Brody Van Wagenen handed him some players with Diaz and whatnot. You know, Alonso was here. That's from another, well, McNeil's from another tenure a long time ago. So there was good bones here that you could have made the argument, hey, you could do the shoehorn approach. And look, they almost went to the World Series doing that. So really, what I'm saying is this. The whole Mets are rebooting, rebuilding, whatever you want to call it, I don't think they're doing any of that. I think this is just the next phase in Stearns trying to win now and win in the future, which is really from day one what Cohen has said and what he said. And we all know they're not going to go into the season with a lot of bouquets thrown at them from the media. Even though if you look on Fangraphs, they have one of the better positional player wars out there, and they still have work to do on the pitching side, but I think there's a lot more variability in the pitching, and there may be more swing one way or the other. And they don't deserve any kind of bouquets. They had an awful, they were one of the five or six worst teams in baseball from the middle of June on. They don't deserve any credit on anything. They deserve every bit of ridicule and scorn that they're going to get. And you know what? Let them sneak up on people, because that's where they're at now. Every bit of equity that OMG built, that the NLC championship run built in 2024, that's gone. A lot of the players are gone. And the love that you had from the fans and the media, that's gone. And that's where I'm going to go before we take a break, because now the real challenge that this organization is going to have is going to be the media business opportunity that has come up from the fact that Stearns did the unthinkable. He did it his way, and he did not kowtow to the demands of the media and the fan rage and paranoia that comes from it is going to be a weapon that they're going to use for clicks, for business, Mets for clicks, and it's rage baiting. And what really bothers me about the rage baiting that it's intellectually dishonest, that it's not presented like I'm presenting to you. Like, I just presented you for about 15 minutes. I said, look, I'm not happy about some of these moves. This is not the direction I would go. However, when I look at the finances, when I look at Stern's history, which we'll get into, when I look at the big picture of who this guy is and how organizations typically are run when a executive of Stern's ilk comes into an organization and usually tears the thing down and does a five-year rebuild. You know, when I look at the whole thing, I understand it. No, that's not what's happening. You got a guy like Mike Puma who every free agent that comes in is put the light on, shown on them to ask them about players that are not there anymore. And constantly regurgitating, clubhouse issue, clubhouse issue, clubhouse issue. You got Mike Vaccaro. And look, I used to get along with Mike. Mike and I have had issues since about 5 years ago when I went after Larry Brooks, the late Larry Brooks, who used to, you know, hockey writer who would moonlight in the summer writing about baseball. And he would spend the summer just doing hatchet jobs on different, typically Mets players, throughout the summer. And I'd be like, hey, Larry, you know, you're not really a baseball writer. It's really easy to come into the club, the press box, and just take a topic and rage bait to get some clicks while you're waiting for the hockey season to start. I find it intellectually dishonest. And one of the things I did on social media is I reminded him, and I sent him a clip of when John Tortorella went after Larry Brooks in a scrum, and Mike didn't like it. And I think Mike has never really forgiven me for that. Now, he's been on the show since then. We've kind of made up. But I think Mike has issues with me and how I handle my social media and how I call out members of the media. And Mike has always been good to me, and I have nothing against them. But I think that's been part of that. But I am disappointed that Mike, in his commentary, actually had the audacity to say, well, maybe the Mets don't even have a plan. I mean, he's putting it out there that maybe the Mets don't know what they're doing. Like, how can you put that out there? First of all, you don't know it, because clearly I could see it. If I could see it, Mike could see it. You know, you want to demand the plan? I mean, what do you want them to come out and do? You want them to have a press conference and put A, B, C, D? Look, let me open up my whiteboard here. Let me turn the camera around into my office. Put the whiteboard up so you can see everything that I'm working on. By the way, hey, Scott Boras, close your ears. This is where we're at in the negotiations with Cody Bellinger. And here's where I'm willing to go. Like, is that what you want him to do? And here's where it gets really bad. Now they're trying to divide us, the fan base, under politics. And that goes back to the whole New York Post and revealing that Lindor's wife is going to be part of the Zoran Mondami transition team. She does a podcast. Lindor's wife has always been very vocal about her political affiliations. And that's even making it worse, because now you got pretty much half the fan base who are probably now going to go after Lindor. You're going to get the other half of the fan base angry at the other half for their politics. And you're really creating an environment, a perfect storm, where something that should be such a beautiful hobby, a fun thing, a thing that gets us away from all this, is now going to bring all this negativity and disharmony to a sport that's meant for us to take a break from it. And I could see the pressure that's going to be, and a tremendous amount of pressure. And look, Stern's signed up for this, and his actions mean he has to swallow the medicine. And I'm sure he knows how unpopular it is, and I don't think he cares. But when you think back to the early season 2024, when I called out the fans for how every single mistake, every error, every play that didn't work out was met with such intense negativity because of how the media covered the team that whole offseason. When Stearns kept saying, hey, I'm here to make the playoffs, I'm here to, you know, have a competitive team, and the media kept saying, they're not competing, they're not competing, they're not competing, they're not competing, they're not investing, they're not investing. Like, it's like over and over and over and over again. Like, the media is really good. They just take a topic, and then they all carbon copy, and they all say the same thing, and it's over and over and over again. And then all of a sudden, like, it's almost like indoctrination. The fans get so frenzied that they go to the ballpark, they're already pissed off, and there hasn't been a pitch thrown. You know, fans are already pissed off. It's not even January 1st, and spring training hasn't even started yet. And I see some of these, you know, Benj makes the roster, Beatty, Jet Williams, some of the young pitchers who deserve to see and to have the experience that all players that played on good Mets teams, especially how good the home field advantage has been over the last couple of years, they may not have that privilege, at least early on, and they're going to have to not only battle the opponent, they're going to have to battle their own fan base, because their fan base, and this fan base is really good at this, saying, I'm going to be miserable, I'm going to go to the ballpark miserable, I'm going to make sure everybody around me is miserable, I'm going to make sure that the players know I'm miserable, and until you prove to me that I shouldn't be miserable, which not now you're adding another layer of complexity, because you're making a lot of money, and it's your job for me to throw multiple stupid obstacles in your way, I'm just going to sit here and be angry. And guess what? The media sits back, and the Pumas and the Vaqueros sit back, and they go, and the typewriters go, and then you got another stupid picture of Mr. Met looking like a bum on the side of the road with a glass of booze. Meanwhile, by the way, the team across town, what, did they sign Amed Rosario this offseason? They haven't done much else either. Okay, they were in the playoffs. They went further, but you can make the argument that they have issues as well, but nobody talks about that. So, you know, they're really, and the politics part is really the one that could really create another layer of the divide. And that's unfortunate because none of that should really matter when we come together. When I come on here, we're all Mets fans, and we may disagree about the Mets, and you may not like my style, or you may not like my opinion. Or you may think I'm too condescending. I've seen that. Oh, Mike's condescending. You know, I get it. But none of what I believe or my religious beliefs or my political beliefs ever comes into play with any of you. Everybody's welcome under this tent. I don't care. Because at the end, we could probably figure that stuff out a lot easier if there wasn't all the media noise. And that's not what you're coming here for. You're not here to hear what I think about the housing crisis or taxation or New York City politics or homelessness. Like, that's not what you're here for. You don't need me. You got enough places to go. That's not what you need to do to hear this from me. Now, look, Lindor's wife, she has every right to do what she wants to do with her money and her free time, and so does her husband. I think she put a bullseye on him. If it was me, I would have probably asked my wife, maybe we stay away. But you know what? She has every right. Whether you like the guy in office in New York City or not, whether you like how she talks about a lot of different political things, and there's a lot of things I don't like that she says, but it's her right to say it, and Lindor has to live with the consequences. And look, I'll tell you one thing about Lindor. Not like him, like him, whatever. He's always been the one, and I could say more so than even Nimmo and Pete and McNeil, you know, who were somewhat businesslike all the time, which is a good thing and a bad thing. Lindor has always been the one that has said, unequivocally, I need to be better. I wasn't good enough. And when he's asked to step up, maybe he's not Jalen Brunson, and by the way, not many people in this town are. Jalen Brunson, if he continues on the way he's going, will probably go down as in the pantheon of New York sports leaders and clutch players. But I'll tell you what, he's had his own moments on the field when the Mets have needed him. And the Mets do not get to game 6 of the NLCS without Francisco Lindor. They don't even get to the playoffs that year. And by the way, Stearns is not stupid. He knows it. He looks back objectively, as he should as an executive, and says, that 2024 team had a nice summer, almost blew it down the stretch the final week. And if not for a Lindor home run and a Pete home run, and basically three home runs, two Lindor home runs and a Pete home run, they're not playing the Dodgers. By the way, now for the first Lindor home run, they don't even make the playoffs. And they were a hair away from losing that game in Milwaukee, that game 3, Pete dropping the pop-up. And if they went down that game, you might have seen a different fan reaction to Alonso than we saw the last couple of years. But you know what? The best part about all this that makes me laugh, before we take a break, I'll leave you with this, is that we kept hearing how execs don't want to come here, nobody wants the job because of Cohen, because of they read Black Edge and they didn't like Cohen's ethics. And the media never looked at themselves in the mirror and say, what you're doing with how you're covering the decisions that the Mets front office has made over the last month and how you've turned it into a punchline and a weapon. And then even when as low as to just, and the New York Post, look, they're all going to look for anything Mondami, anti-Mondami later, or something that's going to rile up the anti-Mondami people. So why not put a ball player's wife on there? So I get what they do. They've been doing that since the guy really became a public face in April. Taking the political part to divide the fan base. I mean, they are clearly using all of this to weaponize and divide the Mets fan base to create a perfect storm of chaos to make your life miserable so that you then give them enough things to write about that aren't baseball related, because they're not smart enough to do what we're going to do after the break and look at the history of David Stearns and look at what he's done and look at what he has at least done in the past to build teams to say, maybe we could glean some information, even though he hasn't had a press conference. Maybe we could glean some information from history, because all the information is in front of us. But that takes intellectual honesty. That takes work. And these guys are none of that. They're lazy. They're myopic. They're over the hill. And they have zero interest in being intellectually honest, because that's not they're not up for the work anymore. They're stale. And I think it's high time that there's a wave of reporters, mainly those who were probably came into the business about 20 years ago, might be time for them to take a hike. It really might be. I'm sorry. And there's some guys that I like, and they may never talk to me again, and I certainly won't appear on this show. And I don't care. I don't ever need a single guest on these shows. The show is about me and about my opinion. And if you don't like it, and if I don't do a good job, guess what? It will go away. So you don't have to, you know, boycott me. You know, they think, oh, I'm going to go on my show. Big deal. People probably want to hear more of what I have to say than someone who works for the New York Post, to be honest, with the exception of a few. So we're going to take a quick break. When I come back, what are the Mets doing? Are they rebuilding? Are they retooling? Are they taking a step back? Can we look at what the Brewers did when Stearns was running them and get a feel of what maybe they'll do the rest of the offseason? And better yet, are you ready? Because I'm going to brace you a little bit. Are you ready for an offseason where maybe they just make component moves the rest of the way? How's that going to sit with you? And can those moves be enough to keep them competitive in the National League? We'll be back. Final show of 2025. We'll be back with more right after this.
I feel like I just want to reject that premise outright. I do not think the Mets are going in with $310 million. I do think they're going to be closer to $340 million. That being said, if we do want to play by those rules, $305 million, then obviously you're going to have to hit the trade market, which means maybe you're looking at getting rid of either a Brandon Sproat or a Joan Tong. You're probably going to need more, even though they have Jorge Polanco at first base. You kind of do want somebody more secure in that position, so maybe a low-cost budget option like a Carlos Santana or maybe a Paul Goldschmidt. But do we really want to be talking about budget options right now when you're the richest owner in sports? I don't think that's going to happen. Sure, they can get Zach Gallen for maybe $45 million, 2-3 years, whatever. But when you have a Cody Bellinger out there, when you have other options out there, there's no reason to be penny pinching at this time. I mean, last year was a disaster. Spend money to fix it.
Steve Cohen is well aware of what the Mets went through a year ago. He's well aware of the fact that there are a lot of fans who are highly skeptical of the fact that Edwin Diaz and Pete Alonso are not going to be a part of next year's team. Steve's smart enough to realize, David Stearns is smart enough to realize, hey, we are the New York Mets. We basically gave Juan Soto $1 billion. And to your point, I have a hard time believing the Mets and budget and financial constraints.
No.
You're telling me that's getting away? The Mets trying to field a championship caliber team? I have a very hard time believing that.
All right, we're back. So what are the Mets actually doing? Do we have any kind of idea? And the answer is not going to be what I told you a lot of the mainstream will do. Let's just go, oh, they don't know what they're doing. They're breaking up the core. They're Scrooges. You know, Stearns is cheap. He only likes, you know, shopping in the bargain bin. And he does look like finding value. But let's just take a look at what he did in Milwaukee, because he's already been doing some components of that since he came here with the Mets. But he really allowed a big chunk of the existing players to find their way and prove that they could get this team to the next level. And I think he saw, like I said earlier, that what happened in 2024, the run they had, the Game 6 NLCS run, was probably the best he was going to get out of some of these guys. And with the way things went down last year, yes, there was pitching injuries. Yes, the pitching was at the reason for the collapse. But, I mean, there was also plenty of instances where, and I even talked about it in July, where the team looked sleepy. They were a very business-like team, but I think at times, sometimes being business-like, and Nimmo was one of the biggest culprits of this. Hey, you know, we could turn it on, we could turn it off, we can you know, go on a run. Sometimes that's not the intensity that winning teams need. Sometimes you need that kind of intensity. And I think that bringing in a guy like Semien, who there was a report how he called out Corey Sager, and bringing in Jorge Polanco, who's known as a worker and a really good clubhouse guy, I think that he's given you an idea of the kind of vets that he wants. And let's also face it, and I think this was brought up on X earlier today, the Dodgers over time, look, they let Corey Sager walk, homegrown star, a few years ago because they didn't want to go to the depths that the Rangers did in terms of the contract. And here's a guy now that's not playing a lot, that's being called out by Marcus Semien when he was in Texas. Think about if that was the Mets and a homegrown star like Sager, that, you know, to a certain degree, they let Alonso go. Not the same. I think Sager's a better player, more premium position. They'd be looking to more than tar and feather Stearns than they already are for what happened. So there is precedent for this. But what exactly are the Mets doing? And in order to understand Stearns, maybe we need to look a little bit at what he did in terms of his Milwaukee team. So I'm not going to go year by year. I'm not going to bore you with that. But if you look at Stearns' tenure when he took over the Brewers in 2016, and that first year they won 73 games. And that was Craig Counsell's first year. And then after that, they had winning records the rest of his tenure. I throw out the COVID year where, even though they had a losing record, they went into a wild card game. I don't really take that year seriously. And a couple of divisions they won. But in 2018, they won 96 games. And they went to Game 7 of the championship series. They wound up losing to the Dodgers. And the Dodgers would go on to lose the World Series themselves that year. But the Brewers had probably their best team in 2018. So let's take a look at that team and let's get a feel of what David Stearns is really about. Now, ironically, the top three offensive players, according to Baseball Reference using WAR, were Christian Yelich, who they traded for, Lorenzo Cain, who they signed as a free agent, Travis Shaw, who they acquired from Boston for Tyler Thornburg. And I'll put a fourth player, the top four players, I should say, Jesus Aguilar, who had a really good year, a couple of good years with Milwaukee. He was a scrap heap pickup off the waiver wire. And that's a perfect example of the kind of player I think sometimes Stearns likes to grab. Hey, let's grab this guy with power. He's not being looked at. We could steal ourselves. They basically stole themselves a 30 home run, 100 RBI guy. By the way, that offense that had those kind of guys and had a declining Ryan Braun, and, you know, you go look up and down the lineup, they had component players like Jonathan Villar and Hernan Perez, Eric Thames. They brought in Mike Moustakas later in the year. They had Jonathan Scope there, Eric Sogard. I mean, they had a whole bunch of component-type players on the bench. Keon Broxton, you guys might remember him for a hot minute with the Mets. Curtis Granderson came in later that year at some point. That was a top 10 offense in baseball, that offense. Not a lot of stars. Yeah, Yelich was a star. Lorenzo Cain was a pretty good player, all-star level player, but I wouldn't say a star. Yelich was their star. Top 10 offense. All the rest of the roster were component players. They were third in the league in defensive WAR, so they're a good defensive team. Now, the pitching was the middle of the road. They had really good bullpen with Jeremy Jeffers and Josh Hader and Corey Knebel. That was a really good bullpen. That's pretty much why they won. And the pitching wasn't really where it would be later on when they won the division again 3 years later, because Freddie Peralta and Brandon Woodruff and Corbin Burns, they're all young pitchers. They weren't ready yet. But you can see how he was starting to build it up. By the time they won it in 2021, Those guys were anchoring the rotation. They still had a component offense. The defense wasn't as good that year in 2021, but at that point, they had a top three staff. So if you really look at Stearns, Stearns wants to build teams on defense and pitching, and he wants the right offensive players, a good combination of offense and defense. If I had to take a guess, his offensive teams are going to be one or two big-name players with a lot of component driven around them. Now, I understand what you're going to say. In Milwaukee, he didn't have the budget to go out and get a start every position. What I think Stearns has been showing you outside of the Soto move and how he's approached free agent negotiations with pretty much everybody is that he believes in shorter-term deals, and if he's going to go outside of the comfort zone, if he's going to start to stretch the budget or put some risk into a contract, it's going to be for generational type of players. Soto fits that bill. He's a generational hitter. When you're talking about a guy that's hanging out at this point in his career, and it's been a long career, but he's still very young. He's only 26, 27 years old, with the likes of Hank Aaron and Willie Mays and Carl Yastrzemski and Mickey Mantle. Like, those are all-time great names. If you're Frank Robinson, if you're hanging out with those names at this point in your career, you could go and stretch yourself and be a little irrational about the contract. For Cody Bellinger, I don't know. You know, maybe Cody Bellinger is the one they'll go a little bit out of their comfort zone because he's an athlete, because he's versatile, because he could do some other things on the baseball field than just hit home runs like Pete Alonso. I think he believes he could find, when it comes to offensive talent, component players, whether it be platoon-type players, whether it players that are more defensive-oriented at certain positions, he can build a competent offense, and one that year was a top 10 offense, and score enough runs, if he has the right defense and pitching, that he can win a lot of ball games. Now, if the Mets budget and with Cohen's largesse, can he do that plus one? I think he will. I just don't think he's going to do it because you want him to sign a big offseason free agent. See, a lot of the times, I think what game you're playing and the media is playing with winning these different ceremonial parts of the baseball calendar, like the trade deadline, like the winter meetings, or, you know, because you lost two free agents, you got to sign one because it's almost like you got to win these kind of PR battles. Stearns is not playing that game. He's choosing not because he knows in the long run that's a road to a busted budget, dead money. Look, he might even be looking at when he had Ryan Braun. When he took over, Ryan Braun was already deep into his career. And I think it was post the steroids accusations. Ryan Braun was not the same hitter that he was during his MVP years. He had a lot of dead money there towards the end with Stearns. And I'm sure that killed his budget. Now, that same player, would it kill a Cohen budget? No, but again, you don't know what the new CBA is going to be, and you also don't know, kind of the financial edict that he's under. The guy doesn't want to lose money. And no, it's not because of his casino, because he's a good businessman, and because one of the things he wants to do is have a sustainable baseball team. And part of that is when you sign a free agent, especially if they have a qualifying offer attached to them, think Michael King for 1 year to maybe get yourself a little bit further, incrementally further in that 1 year, and you give up draft picks, and those draft picks turn into, David Wright, think Colorado and Mike Hampton, you start to kick yourself over the course of time. Look at Carson Bench, look at Nolan McClain. These are draft picks that may produce significant fruit for the Mets next year, particularly in McClain. So I don't think this is a rebuild or a retool. I think what you're seeing is how Stearns is going to go about business, regardless of the largesse and the budget he's got. Now, if there's a generational player available, like Tarek Skubal next year, I think the story's different. He does not necessarily think Kyle Tucker's that. He doesn't think Bellinger's that. I know he's talked to Framber Valdez. He will be in on these guys, but it's going to be on his terms. He's not going to pay A money for what he sees as B talent. C-plus talent, I wouldn't say that, those guys are not, or B-plus talent and give A-plus money. He's not going to do that. They aren't going to spend on a top player unless it's the right player. They aren't going to bloat the payroll. They're going to work on development first. They're going to play derivative baseball. Now, I'm assuming, and look, what was interesting is, as we've been on the air, it came out, Imai, the right-handed pitcher out of Japan, came and revealed that here he is, just days away from his deadline, and he doesn't really have any offers, which is interesting. Makes you really wonder what the hell's going on with the free agent market. It's as slow as anything. It doesn't look like they're in on Okamoto. So the Far East, we had our friend Jim Allen on weeks ago. Murakami signed with Chicago last week. Looks like the Far East is out. We don't know what's going on with Bellinger. That's one name that has been tied to the Mets, so maybe that's still a possibility. Kyle Tucker, if he comes in on a, you know, very aggressive one-year deal, kind of like what Pete Alonso signed last year and Alex Bregman, maybe that becomes an option. But outside of that, I don't know if the Mets are going to be on any kind of big name. So what does that mean? What does that look like? Look, you have 13 offensive roster spots. And right now, if you go to Roster Resource, Carson Benj, Ronnie Mauricio, and Jared Young are taking up three opening day spots. I don't think Mauricio or Young. Now, Mauricio might be able to push himself in the open day conversation, depending on his positional versatility. Young, I think, is a 4A guy. Benj, I think, will get a shot. We'll see if he's ready. You know, he showed some development opportunities when he came up to AAA late in the year. But let's assume Benj makes the team. That really leaves only a couple of spots left offensively. So here's some of the names that you might hear. Now, some of these names have been bandied about in the mainstream. Some of these names we've talked about here over Beyond the Mic. Our friend David Mills, our you know, contributor, has given some really interesting derivative component ideas. But names is, you know, Austin Hayes. He's a guy that mashes lefties. Okay outfielder. You know, guy that if Benj makes the team can spot against tough left-handed pitching. Paul Goldschmidt, there's been talks about the Mets needing a righty batty to play first. I know he's not the MVP Goldschmidt. He does not hit right-handed pitching against, still mash lefties. Oh, there's the narrative. The Mets are collecting former Yankees. But good glove, might be a guy that could fill in, help Polanco a little bit there at first. Polanco's versatile. They may want him around the infield. A name that came up over here, Miguel Andujar, can play a couple of positions, also mashes lefties. Decent arm in the outfield. Ty France, Gold Glover, not the hitter that he once was. He used to be a 15 to 20 home run guy, could play first base, has played other positions. Maybe there's an option. Starling Marte is still out there as a backup outfielder. Chris Taylor, Mike Tauchman, a couple outfielders. I think another name to keep an eye on, a guy, MJ Melendez. He's a lefty, a guy that flamed out in Kansas City, versatile. There's a name that's still out there. So these are the kind of names, and I know they're not sexy, but again, go back to how Stearns built some of those Milwaukee teams as he take and he looks at what he has. I have two top positional players out there in Soto and Lindor. How can I build around them? And let's not forget, they have Jet Williams in the minors. They have A.J. Ewing who might be ready in the next year. Obviously, we brought up Benj. We don't know who else is down there. Nick Morabito, who had a great AFL. These are going to be part of the conversation. They may feel, I don't need a backup outfielder. I have Nick Morabito. You really don't know what they think of these guys, because they're not really telling you. And of course, because they're not names or not on the free agent market and they don't have established resumes, they're not as interesting to talk about during the hot stove. But at some point, everybody didn't have a resume. Austin Hayes never had a resume. Paul Goldschmidt was a nobody. All these guys at some point were nobodies. Remember that. As far as pitching, I think he'll be opportunistic. I don't think he'll go after the qualifying offer pitchers. It'd be interesting if he could sneak in on the EMI, especially if that market is dry. Or maybe there's something about the pitcher they don't like that people are seeing. I think the kind of Manaea deal, the first year when he came in with the two-year deal, the opt-out, I think that's the blueprint of what he's going to go out there. There's Jordan Montgomery. There's Nick Martinez. There's Nestor Cortes. There's Eric Fetty. I think Zach Eflin is an interesting name, a guy that with Tampa was in the Cy Young conversation. I talked about it over at Beyond the Mic. For those love of the game vets, the Justin Verlanders, the Max Scherzers, the Chris Bassett, you could bring those guys in. I mean, right now you have five starters, plus Tong, Christian Scott, Sproat. So you're going to need some innings from the vets. Also, remember, you could bring guys in on a non-roster invitee because you're going to have a couple of guys that are going to wind up going on the 60-man IL. And the roster spots will open up in late March. So if you look right now for the Mets, Tyler McGill's on the roster. He's going to wind up being on the 60-day IL. Daniel Nunez is on the roster. He's going to be on the 60-day IL. Reed Garrett, he'll be on the 60-day IL. So the Mets are going to have three roster spots open up in spring training that conceivably, if the player comes in with, hey, we'll give you guarantees that if you perform, you're going to get a roster spot here, or we'll let you walk and go find a job. That happens all the time. That could happen. So I know that's an off season that you're not going to like, and it's certainly not going to quell the demands of the media, and it's not going to sell season tickets. And that's your prerogative. I already heard fans say, look, I'm not going to spend to watch this team. Unless they spend money, I'm not going to spend to watch this team. But Stearns also looks at the roster as fluid. What is opening day is not June 1st, and what is June 1st is not trade deadline. And truly, especially now with all the changes to the complexion of the roster and the longtime Mets that won't be here come April, the getting to know you phase, what we called here, the getting to know you phase, will be one of the more fascinating getting to know you phases we may have ever done here on the Talking Mets podcast. Really, and as much as I'm scared and anxious about some of the bad that could come out of this, especially because of the fan reaction and the flaming from the media and the rage baiting. Rage baiting is the worst type of media trolling out there because it become very negative and dangerous. And I think there could be a lot of venom spewed at Lindor. I think there could be a lot of venom spewed at Carlos Mendoza, especially if they get off to a bad start. I think it's negative for the young players to come into an environment like that. A lot of those young players, look at a guy like Jeff Kent, just elected to the Hall of Fame. Jeff Kent came up with the Mets at a different time when the organization wasn't so toxic in the clubhouse and the fan sentiment wasn't so toxic. His career trajectory might have been different as a Met. Really. I mean, sometimes it's always right place, right time. Using an NBA example, everybody was talking about Mikal Bridges and how, oh, Mikal Bridges and all the things he does. You know, the Knicks should have drafted him. They wouldn't have had to give up all these assets that they gave to the Nets if they had just drafted him a few years earlier. And then the point a lot of people made is, well, when Mikal Bridges was drafted, the Knicks were in the doldrums. They had a different management team. They had a much more toxic and negative environment around the club. He probably would not have lasted. He would have been traded when they were trying to rebuild. So timing is everything. Same thing with Donovan Mitchell. It's all about timing. When you come into the team and the trajectory of where they are and the development arc and all that other stuff. So I do not think they're rebuilding. I don't think they're retooling. I think this is how Stearns is going to do business. I do not think he's never going to go and push himself out of his comfort zone for a free agent. I think he's going to do it for the right free agent. But I think what you see, the component-driven moves, the focus on defense, the chemistry experiment bullpen, the way they're trying to, you know, find undervalued assets. I don't think that these are things that are ever going to just stop. I think they're always going to be part of his repertoire. And if you look at the 2018 Brewers, his best team that he had, the best shot he had to get into to win a pennant and to get into the World Series as a GM of the Milwaukee Brewers, if that is somewhat of a blueprint of what Stearns likes, go look at that. Go to Baseball Reference. Look at that roster. There is a lot of components to the team right now that they're trying to bring in, defense and what have you. And we'll see if it works. And yes, if a big name comes like Tarek Skubal next year, they're going to be in on him. They're not going to play, you know, this is my value and that's it with a Tarek Skubal. You can't get guys like that. You can't get Juan Soto. You wouldn't have gotten Juan Soto if you did that. It came to an 11th hour bidding where the Mets had to put every last bit of offer on the table to land him. Even when it looked like they had him, they still had to go another step further. And they did. Now, does that mean Cohen did it? Of course, he's the owner. But he went to Stearns and said, do you really want to do this? I'm sure he didn't just do it and say, hey, David. Now, I think Stearns, Cohen in the past, but what he did with Correa in the middle of the night, I'm not so sure that was something Billy Epler would have done. And that would have been a disastrous contract. That was impulsive. That won a headline in December. That made the fans happy. That made the media happy. Luckily, they dodged a bullet. Because that could have been a real albatross in the long run if that had gone through. And I was all for that because I thought they needed that at that time to, again, do the thing that I've been saying that has put this team in harm's way. Leverage the current core. Push the good vibes going forward. No step back. Step neutral and forward. And sometimes now it's not even a step back. It's like, hey, we're going to start doing things more sanely here. We're going to do things my way. You know, if I didn't get in trouble with the royalty rights crowd, I would be playing Sinatra's music right now. But I'd get in trouble and they shut me down. So, all right, let's take a quick break. Final mailbag of 2025. I'll go to the chat room, some emails. We'll wrap up with some commentary from you, the fans, right after this. All right, we're back. Final thoughts. Final mailbag 2025. Let's get to it before we wrap up here. George, we'll start off with George. George wrote to me, the offseason is too slow and boring. A lot of notable players are still available, and it's almost the new year. Need more action and quickness. It's tough to witness. Tired of how the Mets are covered. The media has been bad and how they've handled it. They need to be better. Lastly, another thing that sucks is that we are getting more political talks with the Mets. Some are right, others are left. I'll say this, if the reason they moved McNeil and Nimmo was because of their political leanings, that's scary to think about. I pray that's not how things are operating. So, a lot to unpack. Thank you, George, for reaching out. The offseason is slow and boring. It's not like the NBA. It's not like the NFL. Although even the NBA has had some players bleed into post-Labor Day, which never happened. I don't know if this is a precursor or the owners are trying to make a statement by choking out certain players' demands who are not at the top of the market, hoping that the closer you get to February and pitchers and catchers, that the players will accept less of their market value. Like I always say, once New Year's hits, and that's less than a week away, which is crazy to think about. Here we are, half, 6 inches of snow, half a foot of snow here in New York over the weekend, at least out on Long Island. And we're talking about pitchers and catchers and the baseball season being in our front view mirror versus a rear view mirror. So I don't know what the solution is. I wonder if they'll be able to put something together in the CBA with maybe some kind of roster deadlines. I mean, obviously that'll make it a little bit tougher with some of the deadlines, some of the NBA with the salary cap, where now players have to make quicker decisions. When you're playing with their money and their livelihood, they tend to push back on that. It will be interesting. I don't know what the solution is there, but I definitely think the slowness of the offseason creates more content and clicks, but then there's these lulls where I think people are starting to get checked out. So who knows? I mean, that's kind of a whole nother situation at that point. As far as tired of how the Mets are covered, this has been going on for years with LOL Mets. I think I addressed it a lot during the show. I think rage baiting is dangerous. I think it's dangerous how they're trying to politically divide everybody. They're trying to incorporate politics. I do not think Nimmo and McNeil and any of these guys were dealt because of politics in the clubhouse. I mean, somebody brought up how maybe Nimmo was kind of proselytizing, like Turning Point USA. I don't really think the Turning Point, I look, I know what Turning Point USA does. I don't think Nimmo stood in the clouds trying to convert people to some kind of ideology. I find it hard to believe. Do I think political discussion happens when you're a team of 26 and you eat together or together 12 to 14 hours a day, travel on a plane? It's inevitably going to come up. Could it cause issues with you liking each other? I don't think that it had anything to do with them on the field or why there were issues in the clubhouse. I've heard other things about why Nimmo was an issue, which I'll keep to myself, but those are things that I've been told that were more about him setting an example. Let's just say Nimmo was more about me than us. That's kind of how it's been portrayed, and I'm a little surprised to hear that, but that's something I had, been told. And, whether that's true or not, I don't know. I don't like to spread rumors unless I kind of have some firsthand knowledge, but that's something that's been out there. And that shouldn't be a surprise because I think there's been some allusions to that throughout the media. Look, George, I agree with everything you said. I'm sorry that you feel this way. All we could continue to do here at the Talking Mets podcast is make it about baseball. Over at the website, the visitor at the website, Baloney Pony. So hello, Baloney Pony. Baloney Pony asked me, what's the latest on Matt Allen? It was interesting. You remember former Mets top draft pick. He was one of Brody Van Wagenen's picks in the 2019 draft. I think he was the first third round pick. They wound up paying him well over slot to secure him in the third round. A lot of injuries, a lot of surgeries. Didn't pitch for about 4 years. Came back last year, pitched a little bit in Brooklyn, but was in a minor league free agent. He elected not to re-sign with the Mets organization. And as of now, Matt Allen is a free agent, has not signed with anybody else. So he's an example of a guy that got injured. His career never really got off the mat. And that's that. You know, there's plenty of stories about that. Yes, and I know what it goes back to what we talked about, hoarding of draft picks. I do think, though, the more draft picks you have, you get a higher percentage chance of being right. If I remember correctly, in that 2019-2020 draft, what Brody did was really bet on a handful of top prospects and then not really have enough money down into the later rounds to get some gems that turn out. Sometimes those 8th, 9th, 10th rounders turn out to be, I think Jacob DeGrom, what was Jacob DeGrom? He wasn't even an early round pick. You know, those could sometimes be valuable draft picks. Let's see, what round was Jacob DeGrom drafted? I think it was the 13th round, if I'm not mistaken. Looking this one up real quick. In the 9th round. So, you know, you get what I'm saying at that point. So that's what happened with Matthew Allen. What else do we have here? Let's see. Chat room. Bob says, I believe that David Stearns has a plan and is in business of production wins. They're more important than building minor league results. The core is in flux, so change the players. I trust Mets management. So Bob trusts Mets management. Really, we have no choice. James Schwartz, what do you think will happen if this team is 10 games under at the break next season? Asking for a friend. I got to tell you, James, that is interesting. If they are 10 games under, it is going to be a long, rough summer. The media coverage is going to be bad. Citi Field is going to be a negative place. Carlos Mendoza more than likely will get fired before the season is over. Or if he's not fired, he'll be a lame duck and out. I think the way that I look at that is, why are they 10 games under? Are they 10 games under because of a rash of injuries? Are they 10 games under because of bad decisions they made? You know, Simeon shot, Polanco can't handle first. The kids like Alvarez and Mauricio and Vientos are not developing. Things like that. Benge is not ready. I think if they are 10 games under 500 and it's not because, and the reason is not the kids like Benj, like Jet Williams, I think you're going to start to see them incorporate, if any of the kids are ready, some of the minor leaguers that are the next wave to generate excitement in the second half. It'll be interesting to see, are they 10 games under because of the pitching or because of the offense? If they're 10 games under but the pitching is really good and it's because the offense is underachieving, then that's a different story. I don't think that scenario, you could possibly talk about trading Lindor or Soto. I think the contracts are too complicated. I don't know what the no trade clauses are for either one of them off the top. I'm sure, I think Lindor is going to be a 10-5 guy, right? 21, 22, 23, 24. 20, yeah, he's a 10-5 guy. So I don't even think he can be traded, even without his contract situation. I think that's a loaded question that there's 10 games under is 10 games under. But to me, why are they 10 games under? There's a lot of nuance to that. And then I can answer, what will they do? What I can tell you is, it's going to be rough doing this show. It's going to be rough turning on the radio. It's going to be rough being on social media. It's going to be rough, James. So let's hope that that's not the case. Let's hope that at the very worst, they're in the muck and they're a couple of weeks away from making some big trades at the deadline to make a push to make the playoffs. Frank says, Mike, if they can't move Vientos, assuming that's the plan anyway, what did they do with him? Why not play him at first base the majority of the time and let Polanco spell him against righties? This also is assuming they don't sign Bellinger or someone else that could play first. At least we know Vientos can play the position, which is better than Polanco, who's played an inning. I'm not so sure Frankie could play the position. I know we could have a glove. Frank, you could have a first baseman spit. I could have a first baseman spit. Doesn't mean we're first baseman. I think ultimately Vientos is a DH. I think Vientos, and the hope maybe if he's still around, is that he could be a poor man's Pete Alonso. I think ultimately Vientos is going to be a guy, unless I'm wrong and he develops, is going to be better at producing numbers lower in the lineup, being a really good seventh hitter that can wreck a game, beat up on good, on poor middle relief. I think he's going to struggle with some high velo, with some really sharp arms. I think he's going to struggle. I hope I'm wrong, because I think he had a really good 2024 and he was starting to become a core player. I think he does not have a position. You might be able to play him at third in certain, with certain pitchers who are not ground ball pitchers. You could probably get away with that. But I'm not so sure you could play him at first. I didn't see anything about him at first that made me think he could play the position. And it's not the most premium position. I mean, look, could he be Harmon Killebrew at first and have a first baseman's glove and be adequate? I guess, but I think he's a DH. And I think the best hope is that he could be something like Eugenio Suarez as a DH, pop home runs, drive in some runs. When he gets hot, he could put up a ton of homers and RBIs in a short span. I mean, let's be fair to Vientos. He got off to a really rough start. His metrics always were that he was hitting the ball hard. There was a very thin line between his 24 and, like, if you look, he played 10 more games in 25 versus 24. He had 10 less home runs, but only 10 less RBI in 25. He had one less double. He had 11 less hits. I mean, let's face it. Basically, 11 hits made up the difference between 24 and 25. If he had 10 more home runs, he has the same type of season. Really. To a carbon copy. 2770. 11 hits really made the difference between... That shows you how thin the margin is. Now, if you look at Vientos in... Let's break him down here real quick. So Vientos, let's break him. Do I have him? So if I break him down first half and second half, he had a 778 OPS in the second half, 246 batting average, 476 slugging, 11 home runs, 37 RBIs. You double that, you pretty much have the player that you saw in 2024. Now, he had a really good July and August. He was pretty bad down the stretch in September. He had a 565 OPS. He really only had one. I mean, if you want to be fair, the only good month he had was August when the team was hot. He had 8 home runs and 22 RBIs in August. He's a street hitter. Now, if you look at who the Mets played that month, they played Atlanta. There was some bad pitching in there. I think they had the big game against Seattle. I think he's a seven hitter, and I think he's a guy who's going to feast on bad pitching. I think he's a guy that can lengthen a lineup. I don't think he's in the core of the lineup. I just don't. I think ultimately you're right, Frank, trading him and hoping somebody could be enticed by the power and the potential. The fact that Boris took him on as a client, Boris doesn't take guys on that are chopped liver. He sees something in him, and don't be surprised if his work at the Boris Complex plays. I put a lot of faith in Boris. I think Boris is a sharp guy, and I think he understands how to get the best out of his players. And if he interviewed him and grabbed him as a client, which from what I understand he has, he sees something. So the Mets should at least pause before they give him away 50 cents on the dollar. And power doesn't just grow on trees. Now, to say that he's a poor man's Pete Alonso, it's going to take a lot to be Pete. 40 home runs don't grow on trees. What Pete accomplished in really 7 years here, which in the scheme of a Mets career is long, but still not the longest. It's not like he was here like David Wright. You know, not easy to do. So, well, anyway, that's it. I hope everybody enjoyed this latest edition of the Talking Mets podcast. Another year in the books, guys, and I say this every year. We continue to grow. We continue to grow together. The show gains popularity. I enjoy this more and more. The premium content has taken off, and I've seen more engagement, more subscribers. I hope that you're enjoying. We've amped it up a little bit. More to come in the new year, I think, especially when the season starts. Not that I'll do daily show recaps. That's not what this is about, but I think I'll be doing more audio in between the Sunday shows, because that's kind of feels appropriate when the season starts. A lot more long-form writing during the off-season, a lot more written content. That's why it's beyond the mic. It could be anything. It could be written content. It could be video. It could be audio. Don't forget to vote on the Talking Mets Person of the Year, 3 choices, the breaking up of the core, the pitching collapse, the are 2 of them, and then Juan Soto's near 40-40 year is the third. You could write in whatever you want as well. I'll be announcing that on January 1st. January 1st will be when I announce the winner. So stay tuned. It'll be a video address. The Queen and King of England do their Christmas Eve address here at the Talking Mets podcast. Mike Silva comes to you on New Year's Day with a video with our Talking Mets Person of the Year. So that's that. Sit back, relax. I have a feeling that the wire will be quiet between now and New Year. This is our last show. If something breaks, of course, I'll be coming to you, regardless of whether the ball drops yet or not. But we'll be back with a 2026 show. I got to make sure I get it right. January is always a big month. We have a Hall of Fame show. Obviously, there's still a ton of free agents out there. And then before you know it, a blink of an eye, it'll be February 1st. We'll be staring down a barrel of pitchers and catchers on Valentine's Day. And the journey begins. It'll be another baseball season. It seems like time just continues to fly here. And even though it's the dead of winter right now, baseball's not that far away. All right, I want to thank everybody for tuning in to this last edition of the Talking Mets podcast here for 2025. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets No G and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G. Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You can also check me out, and I highly recommend it, over at the new and improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Get the free chat. Sign up for premium content. Get updates for the show. All at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Happy New Year. Enjoy the rest of your week. We'll be back with our first show of 2026 at this time next week. Till then, take care, everybody.